From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're continuing our documentary film series, and we're talking about the life's work of the Utah movie maker Stephen Grew. Lives in Provo, makes lots of movies, pretty much no budget, but this bedraggled DIY style has attracted a cult following. Scott Christofferson has made a documentary film about Grew, about his dream to make one successful movie. Can he pull this off? Join us after this. Hey, listeners, I'm hoping you'll take a moment to go see the second film in our new series called Habitat. It features the retired designer and architect Bob Bliss. Bob's Craftsman House in Salt Lake City reflects his own aesthetic, but it's also filled with the paintings of his wife, the late Anna Campbell Bliss. Anna died in 2015, but Bob keeps her memory alive in the home they made together. Go see it at radiowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For the people who love Stephen Grew's low-budget fantasy movies, each new release is an occasion. She-Hulk, Tales of Mermaids, The Seedling. His followers don't have to wait long for the next one. Grew is churning them out from his headquarters in Provo. So they're not great, these movies. The acting, the costumes and props, it's all pretty basic, and the result is kind of goofy. But Grew has attracted a cult following. People who text each other when the latest has come out. They have their favorites. They collect the classic lines. And I don't think they're making fun. In fact, I think they're charmed by these movies and kind of inspired by the persistence of the person making them. When you see your first Stephen Grew movie, you'll probably ask yourself, is this guy serious? Well, it turns out he absolutely is. This is no master of irony. He's a dad. He's a BYU film grad who has this oversized dream about making a blockbuster, even though he hasn't found a way to make that happen yet. But in Scott Christofferson's new documentary film about Stephen Grew, he gets this opportunity. The film is a profile of Grew, but it's also about the real costs of following your dream. This is the latest in our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. The film is called The Insufferable Grew, and we're going to be screening it next week. Today, Christofferson is joining us to talk about it. Scott Christofferson is an assistant professor of nonfiction film at Brigham Young University. His previous documentary film, Peace Officer, won both the Grand Jury and the Audience Awards at South by Southwest. He joined us from a studio in the campus of BYU in Provo. For someone who has no idea who Stephen Grew is, just start there. How do you describe Stephen Grew?
Stephen Grew is a do-it-yourself American auteur, I guess you could say. He makes sci-fi fantasy movies mostly. He also does a bit of fan fiction nowadays. He's very eccentric. As one person says in the film, he's an acquired taste. You know, when you meet him, I think people think he's pretty rough around the edges. He can be a little harsh at times. And you'll see this in the film, but Stephen Grew is kind of this obsessive person who just loves filmmaking. I've never met anyone who loves filmmaking as much as he does. And I'm, you know, have been in the film business for, I don't know, 15 years. And, you know, that to me was really inspiring. But Steve, also, you know, in addition to his passion about filmmaking, I think he... you'll see in the film, he hasn't had a job for about 12 years. And so his life is pretty complicated in all kinds of ways.
When did you first see a Stephen Grew film? And give me your initial reaction. Like when you first saw a film, describe it. And how did you react?
Yeah. So I first saw a film, a Stephen Grew film, when I was a student at BYU. He's 7 or so years older than me. So he also graduated from BYU. I remember seeing, I think it might have been I don't know if it was The Seedling or I think that was the film, and you kind of see a transformation scene. And, you know, I was really blown away by kind of the campiness. Mm-hmm. I didn't quite know how to read it, right? Yeah. It was a new experience for me. And so, you know, it was a new experience for me. And at that time, I certainly wasn't saying, oh, I'm going to make a documentary about Stephen Grew. Right. I mean, right.
You didn't know what to think. I mean, it seems like, I have to say, that is the initial reaction, I think, for people who first encounter his films, is like, wait a minute, is this guy a genius or is he crazy and self-delusional, right?
Yeah, that I think it depends on who you ask, but
sure.
I've talked with all kinds of people. You know, good friends of mine put on like a Stephen Grew symposium.
Yeah.
Down here in Provo, like he had created such a big body of work that they kind of asked that question. And a lot of people ask me that, right? Like, who is this guy and how aware is he of what he's doing?
Yep.
What is he doing? Right.
Yep.
And
those are huge questions, by the way. Like, how much self-awareness does he have? How does he perceive himself in, is he a narcissist is a question that comes up. You know, how self-aware is he? I mean, these are really big questions, and we'll get to those. But I think when you first encounter his stuff, that's the stuff that you do ask yourself, like almost right away, it seems.
Yeah. Part of me feels like, well, are all film directors narcissists? Yeah. Am I a narcissist?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Like, I ask that myself that question often, and you know, in the film, one of the characters directly calls Steve a narcissist. You know, I've become friends with Steve over the past, 3 years in making the film. And you know, he's very, very driven. And I think sometimes that drive kind of, you know, at times clouds other things in his life.
Yeah. This sounds like it's hard to talk about because you like him. You have an affection for him. Asking whether a person's a narcissist or, you know, lacking in self-awareness is complicated and difficult. But look, this is the subject of the documentary. These are the questions you really get at. And that's what makes it interesting, I think.
Yeah, I think that's what I want people to ask themselves, right? Like, yeah. Who are artists, right? What are artists doing? And is it worth all of what Steve's doing, right? It's a great cost to his family. They yep. live on a very, like, well below the poverty line, and it's really difficult life, but he just keeps at it. And you know, I think almost everyone who sees this film or since we've screened it in a few places in England, you know, that's some of the questions they ask themselves. And Steve, I know Steve doesn't like it. He doesn't like being called a narcissist. He says he's not.
Yeah.
But I think certainly audiences should and can come to those conclusions on their own. I think that's what I love about filmmaking is they can kind of decide for themselves rather than have me tell them, you know.
Yeah. Let me ask you about the way people describe the appeal of these films, because there's a kind of he's a cult favorite to some. And not that many yet in some ways. It's like this group of people, this still kind of smallish group of people who know Grew, know Grew's stuff. And the way different people in the film describe their attraction is that he's a puzzle, that he's a true, as you put it, an American do-it-yourself auteur, that he is a magician, and you know, he really made me believe, as somebody said. I want to play a moment from Steve and Trish Walters. They worked on at various times on Grew films, and I think they describe, I guess, the appeal in an interesting way. And I wanted to play this moment have you talk about it? Here's a moment from The Insufferable Gru.
To anyone that would watch a Gru movie and say that's bad, I would say you're right in the sense of how standard movie structure is supposed to go. But that's not where entertainment comes from. Entertainment and art doesn't follow rules. It doesn't come from like a set structure.
He has his own perspective. I've never seen anyone who has a perspective like him, and so it's almost like watching a story from a different dimension where it's a completely different rules.
That last thing that Trish Walter said there, almost from a different dimension, completely different rules. Do you think you understand what she's getting at there?
Definitely. You know, the different dimension reference, I think, kind of calls to his story structure as well as like his dialogue. His dialogue is so different than anything I've ever experienced or seen. Yeah. You know, it's not even the way he talks. He's somehow found this unique, strange, weird, way to infuse dialogue, right? Like words like chattering or Jared Hess in the film. Jared's a big fan of Steve's, and
Let's explain who Jared Hess is, or remind people. Jared, really great director. He did Napoleon Dynamite. He did Nacho Libre. And he's one of the big fans. And as you say, he's featured in the film. Can I play that moment I think you're referring to?
Yeah.
Because I think it's you're right. Hess, among other things, is really taken by just the dialogue and how surprising it can be, I think. Here's another moment. This is Jared Hess from the film.
Oftentimes, people fall in love with Steve's work because they find a lot of humor and comedy. But for me, where things are funny, it's because they're shocking. There's always a detail injected into the dialogue that is spoken so casually that it's really disarming.
There's something you should know.
I see it in your eyes. What's wrong?
There was a gamma experiment that went wrong. Jennifer, I am the Hulk.
No.
But enough about me. I'm doing all the chattering. What have you been up to?
Oh gosh, I love that scene.
It's so great. And it's surprising and it's kind of delightful. And I guess that's part of the appeal there.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely knows the formulas of cinema. I mean, he graduated from BYU Film School, but I still can't decide after knowing him for 3 years if he's playing with those or if he says, to hell with it, I'm gonna write what I want and do what I want, and here it goes, right? Like with the Hulk, and all of a sudden they're talking about her criminal law experience after this crazy gamma ray experiment. And he's always infusing these weird names, like, and some might say, oh, is he just referencing Lord of the Rings? But he's talking about like people like Vryce or Vylon or Skyphus or Kyphus. And you're like, and then later on, this is, you know, an amazing part in the film when he's like, he says, you know, you'd never name a main female lead, Vanessa or Felicia. They're slut names.
Slut names. I'd have to say there are these favorite quotes for people who like Gru films, and they probably have them written down. But there are also quotes from the documentary that I found to be terrific. Like, elves have to be able to do a British accent. Or if you speak, do it in an accent. He's talking to extras. I mean, there are a lot of really, I have to say, just funny moments.
Right, that's like a rule he set for himself from another dimension, kind of, right? Like, why do elves have to talk in British accents? It's a rule for him.
Yeah.
And when we screened it, like, the world premiere was in Sheffield, England. Mm. So that went over like crazy. You know, people were just going wild in the audience. And then afterwards asked him to talk in both a Sheffield and Yorkshire accent.
Does he think, as far as you can tell, that the films are really good? Or does he in some way cop to the fact that they can be a little schlocky or cheesy? Do you know what I mean? Like,
yes, I can 100% say that he thinks his films are really good. Yes.
Yeah.
And he'll at times have kind of an asterisk and say, well, I haven't had a lot of money though to make them, and so I can tell that the production quality is a little bit lower than other films, but the story's there. And if I had a big budget, if I had $1 million, if I had multi-$1 million, I can make what anyone else can make. And you know, even I've had conversation with Jared Hess off camera, and you know, at times he said things like, well, you know, if Steve was put into a studio system, you know, he's very organized. Mm-hmm. He knows what he's doing, knows what he wants. He could maybe even pull off a studio picture if he had all that money.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Jared, if you ask Jared, you know, he loves his movies, right? And wouldn't say that his movies are bad. And that's a controversial thing, right? Like that's one of the analyses that you can kind of take away from this experience.
Yeah. Like,
are they bad or are they genius? Are they like Tommy Wiseau, mm-hmm. or Ed Wood? Mm-hmm. Like where, how do we make comparisons? And certainly there's a formula, I think, for like good writing and what makes good writing and what makes for a good film. And I don't necessarily think Steve certainly doesn't follow those rules, right? He does what he wants, and gosh, that's probably why I made a documentary film about him.
Yeah. I have to say, to me, it was like, I think getting to know him made you think differently about those films. Getting to know him made you approach whether these are cheesy or schlocky in a different way. And maybe, like, if he was just this unknown figure, then you would judge the film differently, I think. And that's what's interesting about it is once in the documentary, that's what it's about. We get to know him. And I think people are going to develop a kind of affection for him. And I wonder if you think viewers start to feel protective of Stephen Grew and feel a little suspicious or a little worried that in making a documentary that you might be making fun of him.
Yeah, for sure. That's a fair question. And I think, you know, as a filmmaker, it's really important to me to spend a lot of time with the subject. And you know, I'd certainly developed a love and affection. Like, Steve and I now go out to movies together. Like, he saw Wonder Woman 5 times, and I was on one of those trips with him, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, I think there's a fine line between making fun of and let Steve do what he does and observe him. Hmm. That said, like, we can cut the film however we want. We can portray him however we want, right? Like, it's really, I think a lot of people maybe misunderstand documentaries. I don't know. It depends on the viewer, of course, but, you know, there's a lot of power in like the filmmaking team. They can shape a character how they want. And I think for me, it was important that people saw who Steve really was. And at the same time, understood some of like the personal challenges he and his family were going through, so that they could have maybe a more nuanced decision making process and say, okay, this is what I think about Steve.
Yeah.
This is what I think about his films at the end.
Yeah. There's a moment when you or somebody off camera asks him that. Have people made fun of you? Here's how he responds.
You feel like people have laughed and made fun of you?
Oh, absolutely. I've seen it online. I've seen sites that were actually dedicated to me to literally rip me apart because I went to BYU, because things are low budget, because of the actors, the way it looks. I mean, it's just literally trolls on acid that I've seen. And, well, since speaking of trolls, I was actually compared to the movie Trolls. And Trolls was better than my movie. But you know what? I just shrug it off because I could buy a brand new spanking car that was $500,000 or $1 million or $10 million car, and there will be at least one person out there that will say that there's a scratch on it. they will find something just because of either jealousy or something in their fibers of their body that they feel that they have to be negative. It's humanity. There's always going to be opposites in everything. But in the end, I still made a movie.
And it's true, right? I mean, in the end, he got it done. And it seems like that is part of the charm for Stephen Grew is he just powers through. He gets this stuff done. And that just by itself is kind of impressive. When you think about all the people who dream in the world and they can't manage to just start the project. He has now about 200 films or something. And that's just alone is kind of impressive.
Yeah, his prolificness, not sure if that's a word, is unbelievable. I mean, I have all kinds of film school friends who've never even made a movie, right? Who graduated from film school. And Steve kind of has this producer's mindset as a director, like, I'm going to do 147 shots in a day. We kind of compare him to Stanley Kubrick and other filmmakers who do like 5 shots in a day. I don't know. It depends on the filmmaker. But he when he sets his mind to it, he'll sleep maybe 2 hours a day during the production, you know, maybe 3. He's going 18, 19 hour days. He's so used to like not having any money that he just does whatever it takes to get it done. I'm totally inspired by his drive. Like, you know, I don't have that drive. I mean, I'm on like my 4th feature film and gosh, it's unbelievably difficult to find money or to raise money and to keep it going or to deal with subjects, especially in documentary. But and so to see someone who's doing it like for 20 years in this many movies, like you can compare him to Tommy Wiseau, but like Tommy Wiseau has made 1 movie, right?
Yep.
Nothing else. And that's what's compelling about Steve to me.
He has a pretty healthy sense of self-confidence. Either that or he's covering something up. And that's an element in the film that I wanted to ask you about, because I think that Jared Hess says later in the film that he makes movies almost, and I'm not sure exactly how he puts it. Maybe you can remind me, almost as a way of dealing with the bad stuff
to cope with life tragedies.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that. He comes from he's a kid of, you know, his parents were divorced when he was young. He was bullied. We come to learn this a little bit later in the film, and it gives us another perspective, another bit of an insight for who he is. Let me play a moment here. We'll hear from Stephen Grew's mother and Stephen himself. Let me play this moment. We can talk about it.
Maybe some of those hard times, the drama that he's experienced, which I thought was really grueling, might have prepared him for what he's doing now.
I guess you could say I was like broken. And so it changed my personality to be more angered. It changed me in such a way that I'm the type now where I'm just like, I just don't take crap anymore. And so it's made me stronger in some places and some areas probably too strong.
He says he's broken, and I, you know, a couple of things are interesting. It's interesting that he has that insight, but also that he, as the film progresses, he seems to reveal more. Like, he has this facade at the beginning, self-confidence, and this is who I am, and I don't care if the trolls, and then he just starts to be a little bit more revealing, and I'm wondering, is that what you discovered? Is the more you learned about him, the more you found these kind of vulnerabilities, these open parts in Stephen Grew?
Yeah, you really picked up on that. And that, like, Steve is so used to being an actor in all of his films. I think he's used to kind of performing for the camera, performing this like version of himself that is really self-confident. And, you know, like when he's talking about being trolled, he seems very self-aware. But then, you know, it took forever to kind of like break down this kind of wall with him to where he was really willing to trust me, trust my producers, who are also friends with him. And and kind of open up. You know, it was so hard to get him to just like talk about the difficulties. Like I remember early on, I sat he and his wife down and said, look, I'm not going to make this movie if it's just going to be like all sunshine and rainbows and happiness. Like, that's not interesting to me. Like, what's interesting is that you kind of persevere even though you're going through like a crazy difficult thing. And so, yeah, like later on in the film, he and his wife, I think, open up more. They talk about their vulnerabilities. And I think Steve, you know, he, for those people that are close to him or his fans, like, he is a sensitive guy. He like really cares what people think about his movies. And I think he'd be lying if he said it didn't hurt him if when he hears or sees like hateful comments. I mean, I guess that would hurt anyone, but like, you know, he is really sensitive to that. And I think he became, to his credit, I think he became a little bit more vulnerable as we, you know, 3 years, 2.5 years of filmmaking.
Yeah. One of the big questions, which you referred to earlier, is whether or not the cost just isn't too great for this family. And I think all the people watching are going to, as they see him in his circumstances, which are incredibly modest, and in fact, you see him have to move out of his apartment. You know, there's a flood in the basement, which, you know, for most people, a big deal. But this is a disaster for the Grew family. And you start to wonder, wait a minute. Okay, he wants to pursue this dream, but his wife's the only one really bringing home a paycheck. And is it too great a cost? Let me play another moment from the film. This is Sherry Grew, Stephen Grew's wife.
Yeah.
Obviously, I want to support him. Obviously, I want to have him have fun and do well and practice his art. But yeah, some of that is extremely hard when you're just like, we need that money you're spending on that to pay bills.
I mean, he's tried a lot of things. He tried the police academy, at least seems like for a moment. He worked for BYU. That didn't work out. He tried to be an EMT for a while. That didn't work out. And you reveal in the film his circumstance now, or at least then, not employed, living in a rent-free apartment, you know, owned by his in-laws. They survive on his wife's job. And there's this scene I wanted to ask you about where Sherry, his wife, is talking about how they've managed. She says, you know, somehow we've managed. We've been blessed, as she says, been able to pay the bills and get by. But you can tell she's so worried. And I don't know if this, I'm taking this out of context, but there is Stephen just sitting there playing with a puzzle. And it's going to make someone who watches the film wonder if he gets it, if he understands just how difficult this is on his family. Now, later you come to realize that he probably does, but it does make you wonder.
Yeah. Yeah. Several people have pointed out that same idea. Sherry gets emotional there, and it was just me and the two of them in that room. And she, I think that was kind of the first time she really opened up to me. And I think Steve, it looks like he doesn't really care. I think part of it is like Steve is super focused when he's doing that puzzle. I think behind the scenes, Steve is like a comforting husband, and I know they're in it together, but like the stress in their family is extreme constantly. You know, Steve is also a person that in many ways plays a martyr and at times embraces that role. And that's a really complicated thing. Yeah. Gosh, I do that myself sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he, you know, it's certainly a pervasive issue in their family, and their kids are aware of like their difficult circumstances, especially their older son, Steve Jr. I think Steve, you know, even though, you never know what's going on inside his head necessarily. I think deep down, you know, he really is there for his family and loves his family, but doesn't always necessarily know how to communicate. And that's a lifelong process, right? But
yeah,
it's challenging.
They'll be there for a Q&A after the film, so join us. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Do you work for the University of Utah? Are you a public radio nerd? Then donate to KUER through payroll deduction. Decide how much of your paycheck you'd like to put toward programming like Morning Edition, 1A, and Radio West, and the university will send your generous gift to KUER. Your contribution supports factual journalism, Utah stories, and even short films. Get started with payroll deduction by looking under the support tab at KUER.org.
His philosophy, as I'm able to discern it throughout the course of the documentary, is interesting. I mean, he likes to play, for the most part, the main characters in his films. He loves movies. I guess he just wants to be in them. And there are times when I couldn't tell if he would rather be an actor than a director or there's something that he says in the film also that part of the appeal for movies for him is that he can bring fantasy to life, like give himself or other people superhuman powers. And I'm wondering, you mentioned that you guys went and saw, or at least he saw Wonder Woman like six times or something like that.
Yeah, yes.
Is that must be part of his worldview, I guess, is this idea of superpowers and fantasy. That's big for him, I guess.
It's huge. Like, he developed that, I think, in his childhood, you know, when his father left at age three. It was just him and his mom, and his mom had to work, a single mother, right? And at times he had to be alone, and he says this in the film a little bit, like, create his own worlds. Mm-hmm. I think it's both a defense mechanism, an escape route for what's really going on in his life, and it's enabled him to do some really creative, amazing things. Yeah. And at times, you know, it really kind of points to what Jared Hess said about coping with the tragedies of life. I think maybe he doesn't always want to face those, like all humans might not want to face some of their challenges, and, mm-hmm. and instead says, well, I'm good at this, or I can do this. This is what I love to do. I'm going to escape a little bit. I'm going to get away from all of my financial ruin or concern that has been dogging me my entire life.
I want to get to the kind of crucial turning point in the film. Once we get to know Stephen Grew and his body of work, after 166 films, as you put it in the documentary, he meets with a producer for the first time. And it's this project that sort of raises the stakes and makes the elements of the film really, really interesting. Let me play a moment. This is when Stephen meets Jared Harris. Now, Jared Harris is a producer. He's happens to be a producer in this documentary, but also a potential, at least in this moment, producer for this film that Stephen Grew wants to make. And this is where it brings. This is the fascinating part of bringing the documentary together with this film project that I want to get to. But let's play this first initial meeting when Stephen Grew meets Jared Harris.
How's it going? Stephen Grew.
Stephen, nice to meet you. I'm Jared.
Glad to meet you.
I've always been very interested in meeting you. There's something that I really love about your passion. My whole goal is to give you the resources to be passionate about a bigger project. So maybe what are some of those things? Is there like a movie that you have, that you've like always wanted to make that you haven't been able to?
There you go. Unexpected Race. I want to see that on the big screen. I always did.
All right, explain Unexpected Race before we get to some of the other stuff. Like, this is a film that he already made back in 2004, I think it was.
Yeah, so he remakes a film. The Unexpected Race is it's an elf-human love story where the FBI is trying to wipe out the elf race. And the last of the elf race, right, is falling in love with this 18-year-old girl who's also kind of figuring out her own identity. All along the way, you know, his old FBI nemesis is trying to kill him.
Yeah.
Because he killed his partner. That's the unexpected race.
Right, right. And he says his idea as he's talking to Jared is, you know, $1 million budget, you know, just for starters. He has these big ideas now because someone, and maybe set this up for us or talk a little bit about this. Now all of a sudden there's this potential for someone to actually fund this film. He doesn't have to just do it by himself. And this is where it seems like the documentary converges with the filmmaking itself. Talk a little bit about this, because this is kind of an interesting element, I have to say, in the doc.
Yeah, I think to understand that, you got to understand when I first met Steve, it was me and my producer, Eric Robertson. Eric had acted in one of his films. I saw it and I said, "Hey, Eric, let's go to lunch with this guy." We went out to lunch and we said, "Hey, Steve, we want to just follow you as you make your next film and whatever that is." And we kind of, in a way, challenged him and said, like, it'd be great if it was a feature film because that would mean a lot more for a documentary. We also said from that initial meeting, I had no idea who Jared Hess was, but I knew Jack Black was a fan. And I said, let's try to get one of your A-list stars in that movie. We had no clue if that was going to happen. And it really kind of did happen the way that it happens in the film, in that, like, we didn't know if Jack Black was going to be in the film or not.
Yeah.
And
but
so
wait. I have to say, that's such a crucial moment, because I've heard you in interviews say, "Oh, when we got Jack Black," and I'm like, "Well, wait a minute. What do you mean when you got Jack Black? Don't you mean when Steven got Jack Black?" And then I realized, no, it's when you both got Jack Black, because that's where those two films kind of come together, which is really interesting.
For sure. I mean, it helps our documentary in all kinds of ways. With notoriety, with having a famous person in it, like, you know, our documentary has already been purchased and is going to be distributed. You know, I would say Jack Black is a huge part of that.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
And so, yeah, the we in that is it was challenging. I definitely, as the director/producer of the doc, was hands off. You know, my motto was, do not solve Steve's problems for him.
Right.
So that was what we did. Jared Harris had the same motto. Like, Jared really just, he was a producer in a way, but Steve really produced that movie. It was not Jared. Like, because Steve is so used to being producer and director and craft services and
right.
Everything,
yeah.
Right? Like, yep. Staff that we said, okay, we want the full GRU experience. But it is more complicated, though, because, you know, it's like we're kind of producers on his film as well as directing, producing the documentary. And it was complicated and complex, you know, for sure.
Yeah. Jared Harris asks, you know, Stephen in that meeting, you know, like, who's your fantasy cast? And of course he has one, and some really big names. Sam Rockwell, let's put Bruce Willis in here, and of course then he throws in Jack Black. And the fact that Jack Black comes into this story is really interesting. Let me play a moment from Jared Hess, who explains how it is that Jack comes to be a fan of Stephen GRU.
I've introduced Steve's work to just about every actor and crew person that I've worked with. So all of the films that I've done over the years, as a wrap gift, generally I will buy a selection of Steve's films and give them to the actors as wrap gifts. I gave that to like Sam Rockwell and Jemaine Clement. Jack Black, when we were working together on Nacho Libre, I had a bunch. Like, I literally, after a day of scouting, I would decompress in the van and watch Steve GRU movies. And everyone's like, what are you watching? This is incredible. And it would be like, I'd be watching The Crown or The Yen Rai or whatever, maybe some of his music videos. And Jack Black immediately became a fan.
Do you have a sense, and I don't know, did Jack Black sign on because the documentary made it novel, or was it a sincere, earnest desire to be part of a GRU film because he had this kind of cult fascination for it? I mean, or was it a little bit of both? Can you tell?
I would say it was a little bit of both. But I would say primarily, like, he legit loves Steve's movies, yeah. Like, loves them.
Yeah.
And he's loved them since, what, 06? That was when Nacho Libre came out, right? Or, right. What, 05, 06?
Yeah.
So he has purchased, like, all kinds of Steve's movies. Like, and he's one of, like, the most sincere, like, down-to-earth dudes for an A-list star. I mean, I guess I haven't met that many A-list stars, so I don't really have a barometer, but he was rad to work with, like, was so easy and fun and just, like, naturally funny. But he was certainly intrigued by the fact that, like, oh, Jared Hess was a producer on our documentary, right? He and I worked pretty closely together on it. But I know he sincerely has always wanted to be in a Steve Gru movie. He's always had kind of an affinity for, like, the do-it-yourself
yeah.
people.
Let me play a moment with Jack Black. We'll hear Jack here, and also Jared Hess, where they talk about this day of shooting, which was kind of a dream come true in some ways for Stephen Gru. Here's another moment from the film, The Insufferable Gru.
To tell you the truth, I was a little worried. You know, his enthusiasm was infectious. He wanted me to be in the movie, and I really wanted to be in the movie by the end of the conversation. But there was a little voice in my head going, be careful. You don't really know the real Steve Gru. You just have seen these films, but you haven't. There could be a monster diva behind all this stuff.
I think Jack was more nervous going to work with Steve than he has any director ever. He didn't want to disappoint. Jack did not want to disappoint Steve Gru.
Which is so great. You know what it said to me, too, is that basically Steven says that he says, I've done enough acting to prove that I can connect with people. But now I want to show that I can really direct. And so you get this sense that the stakes for Stephen Gru with this film are really high. And he really comes off as really vulnerable.
Yeah, the stakes are so high for him. They still are. The film hasn't sold. He wants it to sell desperately. And thinks that it can, right? Thinks that it could really make a big splash because of Jack. And so he wanted to work with Jack like any other big director did, right?
Yeah.
And wanted that experience. And for me, it was like, gosh, it was like such a, as someone who's observing Steve, such a wonderful moment of like, yeah, this guy can be difficult and a lot of people are turned off by him, but he's been through so many financial and personal setbacks that you're like, yeah, maybe I want to root for him now, right? Like,
yep.
Maybe
yep.
Finally he's like got something that's yep. like going for him. And that was, it still might be like the happiest day of his life other than, you know, getting married or having kids or whatever, but I don't know, maybe more. I don't know.
Well, you never know. I mean, you yeah. never know. I mean, that wouldn't be inconceivable that was he calls it a perfect day.
Yeah. Yeah. We, you don't see this in the film, but we also went to Disneyland for like an hour and a half, and sprinted with him to, like, he hadn't been to Disneyland in 13 years and sprinted like every possible ride he could get to because he was like on fire. And then of course the nights are kind of bleeding together, but then he wanted to go clubbing and
yeah.
you know, dance the night away until 3 or 4 a.m.
He loves to dance. It's amazing. He took a break on a road trip to Los Angeles to stop in Nevada and dance in the road, which is another really interesting moment. But yeah. I want to play this other section from the film, which is, you know, Jack Black is like, asks, gosh, I wonder, is there this monster diva behind all of this? And on some level, working with Stephen Gru, he can be kind of a monster diva in some ways. And part of the film is the way he works a crew, exhausts them, doesn't take into account their their own concerns, his working with his director of photography, this really smart, clever young photographer, a filmmaker, Lauren, is really interesting. And there's this moment when she comes to confront him. She's going to quit. She goes to his she goes to his apartment to say, look, I'm not going to take this. And his reaction, it's almost one of the realest moments in the film where he seems to just break everything down. Now, keep in mind, things have not gone well with the shooting of the film so far. He's had this flood in his basement, which seems like a disaster. I have to say, at this moment in the film, Scott, I was so stressed out. He's not getting permits. He's not getting permission to shoot in this stuff. And he's driving the crew. Oh, man, it was crazy. But then Lauren goes to Scott's apartment, his house, to confront him. Here's that moment.
If simply respecting someone for their skill set and for their contribution and for the time that they are donating to your project isn't enough, I think that your dismissal of my suggestions of that relate to my knowledge and my skill set is hurting your film. Even if you don't care that it's disrespectful to me or my crew, it's your film is suffering because of it. My opinions, my suggestions, they come from a place of knowledge, and I do think that
and
they
I've
deserve
respected
to not
that.
Be
That's
dismissed.
Why I listen to your stuff on set, especially, and I listen to that even in pre-production. If you remember our conversation,
you fired me after that conversation. Actually,
yep, and I kept you on too. And you guys don't know what's going on. I'm about to lose my house. I'm about to be kicked out. They just dismissed our claim to fix my basement. We all have our life problems, and I'm trying as one person to help everyone be happy in the end. I've tried.
Great. Thank you.
I have to say, it seems like one of the only times in the film where he seemed absolutely real and just kind of frankly broken.
Yeah. Steve doesn't love that scene, you know, and maybe that's why. Maybe it's because he's so vulnerable and, you know, my student shot that scene, Helen Butcher, and went there and filmed it. And I think Steve, Lauren wasn't prepared for that, right? Like here, Lauren is a student at BYU, comes from a pretty well-to-do family. They come from very different socioeconomic backgrounds. And he's kind of saying, look, I love it because I think he's saying, look, like I'm dealing with like four kids and we're going to get kicked out. Like, I don't know where we're going to live.
Yeah.
And I think it was an eye opener for Lauren. Like, she didn't expect that. And for me, I think it's like, I kind of like, you know, related to Steve a little bit there as a father of three and someone who, gosh, I have a luxury of being a professor who has a salaried job, but what if I, you know, I'm a filmmaker just the same. And what if I was in his shoes and, you know, I worry about that, right? Like, I don't have to right now, but every filmmaker or independent filmmaker does. And I love that scene because of it, because I think it reveals Steve and, you know, when Steve listens to this, hopefully he knows that I think it's wonderful to see how really is in that scene.
Yeah. Let me ask you finally, I read a review of the film, your film that, and I think this seems right to me that viewers' allegiance to Stephen Gruber, it's going to be tested throughout. But I'm guessing you're hoping that people come back around to him because you're going to wonder if he's just kind of cruel and a jerk at times. But then you see the passion. I think that, as someone puts it, it's pretty great to see passion. That's what you see with him. So it'll be interesting to see where people come back around if they do.
Yeah. And I think, I always tell Steve, like, it's okay to disagree, man. Sometimes he can be a jerk on set. I can be a jerk. I've been a jerk all kinds of times in movies that I've made and regretted it. You know, I don't want to persuade people to like love Steve though.
Yeah.
In any way, and you know, all kinds of people have been totally turned off, and that's fine, right? Like, that's their decision, and I think, as a filmmaker, it's really important to me, just like in other films that I made, that audiences, that you give a lot of credit to your audience, that they're smart, they're intelligent, they're going to know and decide for themselves and feel for themselves. And it's kind of that, personal experience, right? They're going to bring their all of their own personal experiences, whether they're female or male or whatever, and decide, well, should I love Steve? Should I despise him? And for me, it was important that I, you know, observed him and let the audience glean what they wanted to glean.
Scott Christopherson, he's a film professor at Brigham Young University. He directed the new documentary film, The Insufferable Gru, which we're going to be screening next Wednesday at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. This is part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Christopherson will join us for a Q&A after the film, and so will Stephen Gru. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Michael Havey. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.